Good afternoon, good afternoon, good afternoon. It is a Tuesday, June the 7th, 2016. 12:13 coming up on 12:14 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And you are tuned into the Now program. I am Scott Spears. And today we're going to continue on with our week-long tribute, and he certainly deserves a week, remembering a man who called himself this, and he certainly deserved it, the greatest of all time, Muhammad Ali, who sadly passed away last Friday evening at the age of 74. We do want to thank, because we ran out of time yesterday, we do want to thank longtime HBO boxing analyst Larry Merchant and Chuck Wepner for being on yesterday and sharing their thoughts of Muhammad Ali. And we've got a great hour this hour. We're going to be joined in the bottom of the hour by legendary boxing trainer and promoter Lou Duva, coming up in the bottom of the hour to remember Mr. Ali. But kicking off this hour, we have got a great guest. He's a former boxing world heavyweight champion. He worked with Ali. He sparred with Ali. And in one of Muhammad Ali's last few matches, last title match, this man was the opponent. He is Larry Holmes. Larry, how are you?
Hey, I'm doing fine.
How did you hear of Mr. Ali's passing last week?
Well, some people called me that said that he was sick and that they were taking him over to the hospital. It didn't look good. And they told me they would call me after they get all the detail. And I told them, okay, next thing I know, they said he was not doing good at all. And I went to bed, fell asleep. My wife woke me up at 6 o'clock that morning, 5 o'clock that morning, said Ali had passed. And that wasn't good to wake up to.
When did you first meet Muhammad Ali?
I met Ali in 1970-71, and I did boxing exhibition with him down there in Reading, Pennsylvania. Before he built a camp up in Deer Lake, he was out there looking over the spot and looking over the places that he wanted to build a camp. And I happened to be there, and he told me, I told him I was a boxer, you're a boxer, so he said, put up my hand, so I put up my hand, and he jabbed, and then I put up my hand, and he jabbed again. He said, want to do a boxing exhibition? I said, sure. So I did a boxing exhibition with him in Reading, Pennsylvania, a black eye. And he said, let's put the mice on the eye. I said, no way in hell. I said, I'm going to show this off because I'm proud to say I boxed with Muhammad Ali. So no way I will let you put ice on the eye. So that was the end of that story. And then I became a very good friend with him later because I was allowed to come to the camp, work out with him, work out, and we boxed. And it ended for about 4 years as being a sparring partner for him.
What did Ali mean to you before you met him? What representation was he of a young boxer?
I liked him because he talked about it. He talked about how good he was and how pretty he was and how he was going to be the champion of the world. I like that. You know, I really like that. I like when he guy was bragging about himself, but he was also backing it up. That's what it was that I liked about him. And then I got the chance to work with him, to train with him, and hang with him. I mean, you know, it was like mind-boggling to say that I'm working with one of the greatest fighters of all time, Muhammad Ali. I mean, that's mind-boggling in itself. Nobody believed it, but you know what? I didn't care. I kept telling them, I showed them pictures. They still didn't believe it until they seen him and I working out at the camp when they came up to see him. And, you know, that showed that I was telling the truth.
What kind of man was he away from the cameras and microphones?
Well, if we had no cameras around or nothing like that, you came up to him and said, can I have an autograph? He would give you the autograph. Can I take a picture? He would take a picture with you. But you know what? A lot of them other celebrities don't do that. And that's what I got. I got from Ali, man. You know, you don't turn people down. Ali was a great man when it come down to that stuff. He's a people's person, a kid's person. He's everything. I mean, this guy, I mean, he can be doing something and you ask him, he'll stop and look at you and do things that you want him to do before he finished what he had to do. He was that kind of a guy. But, you know, people had the good about him and they had the bad about him. But I was with him at 4 years as a sparring partner. And I ain't never seen anything stupid, nothing. He never did anything like that except for... except for fighting me. That was the only thing that he did was, you know, shouldn't have done. But, you know, I understand it because it was about the $10 million. It was kind of hard to turn down $10 million. And I fought him, beat him. I gave him a black eye like he gave me, you know. And I hugged him, and I said, man, you know, I love you. He said, if you love me, why you beat me up like that, man? So, you know, he didn't have any hard feelings. Good guy. And a lot of, he have more men in him than most men have.
I do want to talk about that. That was Ali's last title fight was with you. He had one more fight after that before he ended his career. Mm-hmm. Did you know how the disease and his shape and age had crept up on him when you signed for that match?
No, I didn't know what they did. Because what I was hearing, that they took him to the hospital, made sure that he was fit to fight. They took him to the Noah Clinic or whatever, Cleveland or whatever. I don't really know a whole lot about it. And all I know that the day they took him, he got me, he was okay to clear the fight me. And I prayed not to hurt him, and I didn't. And I told him the same thing, don't get hurt, you know. But, you know, Ali, he was a hell of a guy. He took what I gave him, and he would have never quit. He would never quit if they didn't make him stop, if they didn't stop the fight. So he would still be fighting today if he could, you know. But
you know,
he was a great man. He was a great human being.
It's interesting, Larry, because I talked about this yesterday with Larry Merchant. Most boxing insiders knew that that was not a good idea for him to take that match, and it probably did have to do with money. But the public still believed that he was going to win that. They had seen him take on Foreman and come back. They thought he could do it because he had done the unthinkable. Going in,
right.
Did you have any trepidation that maybe he could pull another one off?
No, because I told him his body's making the day his mind can't keep. His mind's making the day his body can't keep. And, you know, the odds changed. I was favored going in, and then when it was time for the fight was even. So everybody thought that Ali was going to pull one off, you know. But except me, I knew all I did was tell Ali, I said, man, you're my friend, you're my man, I love you, let's get the money. I said, but don't get hurt. And he said to me, shut up, I'm going to knock you out. And he talked like that until the end of the fight. And even when I fought him, I beat him. They took him back to the dressing room. I went back to his dressing room. I gave him a hug and kiss. And I said, man, you know I love you, man. And he said, if you love me, why you beat me up then? You know, and we all busted out laughing, you know. And then he said, I'll be back. I'm on home. We're on home. We left out feeling better than we did when we went in.
You know something that's interesting, Larry, that I have found fascinating over this past weekend? Ali had many arch nemesis in the ring. You were a big fight of his. Foreman certainly was a big fight. Wepner was a big fight. Frazier was a big fight. But this past weekend, unfortunately, with Joe already passing away, but the people who fought Ali, you, George Foreman, and Chuck Wepner, all had affection for him. What was that even though he was a challenger, even though he said he was going to knock you out, and in George's case, he did, and in Wepner's case, they went the distance, why do even his opponents have such reverence for him?
Because we know the guy had a good heart. The guy didn't want to hurt nobody. He wanted to continue to do what he did, but he didn't want to hurt nobody. He had a great heart, and he would give you the shirt off his back, you know, if he could. Ali was a good man, and I didn't want to hurt him. I didn't want to fight him. But when you're putting up $10 million for Ali, which he needed, and he gave me $3.5 million, what are you going to do? Turn it down? No, you don't turn it down. You get the money. And that's what Ali did, and that's what we did. And that's what we're glad that we did that.
When was the last?
We got the money.
When was the last time you saw or spoke with him?
The last time I saw him was about 4 months ago in January, I guess, down in Kentucky. We did the Hall of Fame or the museum down there, and he was still scared, down in the ground, sweating, and nobody was with him, but he was just sitting there in the chair. George Foreman came up and started trying to talk. He got nothing. I tried to talk. He got nothing. You know, but we just sat there and, you know, was talking to him, but we never was getting anything out of him. But that was a great, good moment for me, but it was a bad moment, sad moment for me, you know, because I didn't want to see Ali sit there sweating, not being able to talk. And he sat there. George Foreman tried to talk to him. He said nothing to George. George said claimed he did, but he didn't. And it's just sitting there sad, man, to see somebody like Ali. Because you know what? He helped me. He gave me my first pair of boxing gloves, man. Him and Gene Kilroy put gloves on my hand to be a sparring partner for him. 1971 up in Deer Lake, Pennsylvania. And, you know, and I got the black eye out of the deal. And I was happy to get that black eye out of the deal. They didn't, like I said, they didn't believe me that I worked with Ali, and I had to show them the eye, and they didn't believe it anyway. So, but I had the pleasure of being with one of the greatest fighters of all time, of my time, certainly my time. I mean, you can talk about the Jim Lewis, the Dempsey, the Marcellus, and everybody else. I don't know those guys, but they were not great to me. Ali was great to me. He would not snide you. You want autograph, he would sign it and give it to you. A lot of these athletes, they don't want to give you nothing. They don't even want to give you the time of day. So therefore, you know, in my opinion, Ali was the greatest boxer out there. Including greater than me.
Well, and that's a tough thing for an athlete to say, but with this guy, everybody has such reverence. And it's very interesting, and I should mention, because from where we are right now, Louisville, Kentucky is only about 5 hours away. That's where the service will be on Friday at 2 p.m. And speaking at this service, when you look at this, former President Bill Clinton, Bryant Gumbel, former host of the Today Show, and comedian and movie star Billy Crystal. Larry, will you attend the service on Friday?
Yeah, I will be there. I will be there. You couldn't keep me from being there. I will be there, you know, and all these people will be there. So I don't know what kind of mess we're going to be in trying to get next to Ali, close to his body, you know, or close to somebody that loved him, you know. I know Ali. I know Ali's kids. I knew his wife before she was his wife. I knew the kids before they became 3 years old. I've been there that long. You know, I've known Ali before his kids were born. I know him with his second wife. That's when I first met him, with Linda, and then the Veronica, and now Alami. I know him. I know all of them, man. And it's like homecoming, you know. But
well, that's
Ali won't be there.
Well, Larry, this is one of the interesting things, and I haven't heard this much talked on the news, but the service Friday will be in Kentucky, which is not New York, is not L.A., where a lot of people live, but I have so far learned that Chuck Wepner is coming in for this, Larry Holmes is coming in for this, Don King is coming in for this, and I haven't heard about George Foreman yet, but it's amazing that people who aren't even part of the service, who aren't speaking, who have big lives of their own, are converging on Kentucky on a Friday afternoon at 2 o'clock to pay homage to this man. I think that says a tremendous amount.
It should be a holiday, man. Mainly's got to make a holiday out of this, because I tell you, he draw people. He put people together. I mean, he go to the Middle East and fight. He went over to Zaire, Africa, and fought. He went to the Philippines and fought. He went around the world, man, made speeches and stuff like that. And he can bring people together, and he did. And everybody loved him. He went to Cuba. and brought people together over there. I mean, he was the man. Listen, presidents can't do that. They got to get permission to go over there. I just make one phone call and say, I'm coming over. And they open the door wide open for him. So, you know, he was, that's how great, that's how much he had influence on people. And he put his, you know, I mean, you know, he's definitely going to be missed by all the fighters that in the world that want to act like or pretend they're Muhammad Ali, and all the people like myself that were around and we fought Muhammad Ali and trained with Muhammad Ali. I don't think there was anybody next to Ali fought or trained with next to him but Jimmy Ellis. I think Jimmy Ellis might have been the first one to stay with him because, you know, they were there together, they came up together. But I was the second one then, or the third one. But I was there for him. And I, one of the things that I didn't try to do while I fought him, it hurt him. That wasn't not my plan. My plan was to win, make some money, let him get out of there without being hurt. And I think I achieved that.
Larry, before I let you go, and I want you to think on this for a minute, what is Muhammad Ali's legacy? But before I do that, I want to play a clip for the audience. This is very interesting because, as most people know, before Muhammad Ali became Muhammad Ali, he was Cassius Clay. He was one of his first television appearances was on the Jack Parr Tonight Show, 1960, I believe this is, and he is performing on the Jack Parr Tonight Show, national television, The Piano Man is Liberace, if you can believe that. Here's that clip.
Well, you recite something and I'll make up the music to it. For a change, do the one about you.
This is the legend of Cassius Clay, the most beautiful fighter in the world today. He talks a great deal and brags indeed of a muscular punch that's incredibly speedy. The physic world was dull and weary. With a champ like Liston, things had to be dreary. Then someone with color, someone with dash, brought fight fans a-running with cash. This brash young boxer is something to see, and the heavyweight championship is his destiny. This kid fights great. He's got speed and endurance. But if you sign to fight him, increase your insurance. This kid's got a left, this kid's got a right. And if he hits you once, you're asleep for the night. And as you lie on the floor while the ref counts 10, you pray that you won't have to fight me again. For I'm the man this poem is about, the next champ of the world, there isn't a doubt. Here I predict, and I know the score, I'll be champ of the world in 64. If Cassius says a mosquito could pull a plow, don't ask how, hit him up.
Larry, when you hear that, what does that make you think?
Take me back into the day, man, when I was laughing like everybody else in this audience, man. I was laughing. I wasn't there when he was doing that, but because I was still a young kid yet. But that's what made me like him, when he was calling Sonny Liston the Bear and everything else, you know, and I like that, you know. And he's going to knock him out for it. We won't see him no more. Knock down the age, you know, do the ride your opponent. I like that, and he was good at it, and therefore made me want to be around him and around him. And that's what I did.
Larry, what's his legacy to the world? What has he left?
Listen, man, you take all the presidents, all the monuments they did, got of great guys that did great things. Ali's right in the middle, or right up front with all of those guys. When he said he's the greatest of all time, at that time, he was the greatest of all time. And he had no argument with me. And when I fought him and I beat him, and he said he was still the greatest, and I still didn't have no argument with him, you know, because to me, he's a great man, and I told him that he's always going to be a great man. He gave me a job, put food in my mouth, helped teach me how to fight, that would teach me how to be a person around people. And that takes a hell of a man to do.
Larry Holmes, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your memories. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, okay.
Bye-bye. Legendary boxing world champion Larry Holmes. We're going to take a quick break here, listen to some great talk from the legendary Muhammad Ali. Come back with Lou Duva right after this.
It wasn't a close fight, was it?
No, it wasn't a close fight.
Was it close before I knocked him out?
No.
Is this on close? You tell. Is it live?
Right now.
Everybody, stop talking now. Attention. I told you, all of my critics. I told you all that I was the greatest of all times. When I beat Sonny Liston, I told you today I'm still the greatest of all times. Never again defeat me. Never again say that I'm going to be defeated. Never again make me the underdog until I'm about 50 years old.
That's right.
Then you might get me. But I didn't dance. I didn't dance for a reason. I wanted to make him lose all his power. I kept telling him he had no punch. He couldn't hit. He's swinging like a sissy. He's missing. Let me see your box. I hadn't started dancing yet. You can't say my legs are gone. You can't say I was tired, because what happened? I didn't dance from the second round on. I stayed on the ropes. When I stay on the ropes, you think I'm doing bad. But I want all boxers to put this in the page of boxing. Staying on the ropes is a beautiful thing with a heavyweight when you make him shoot his best shots and you know he's not hitting you. I would have gave George Foreman two rounds of steady punching, because after that he was mine. But he was falling. He was missing. I don't know if I'm going to fight again or not. I'm going to retire as of now.
Tell me, what did you say to George Foreman before the fight? What did you say?
I told him he has no power in the corners and in the clinches. I said, shoot your best shot. I'm going back to the ropes. They told me he was strong. Didn't I look stronger than him?
Tell me, Mohammed, this is the thing that puzzled people. Why was it when you were on the ropes that he could not hurt you, even when you were right there on the ropes?
Blocking, and I was pulling back, and I have a radar built inside me. I know how to judge punches. Didn't I tell all of you out there, on your local radio shows, mostly black stations, I told you, I'm going to float like a butterfly and sting like a bee. His hands can't hit what his eyes can't see. So that's what happened.
That's what you said to me. But tell me now, are you really going to retire, Mohammed?
I'm seriously thinking about retiring. There's nothing else for me to fight. I told her, well, I'm going to retire. I'm going to hold the title for a few months. They took my title unjustly. I told you, I'm the real champion. I told you, I'm the champion of the world. All of you bow. All of my critics crawl. All of you suckers who write the Ring magazine.
The great Muhammad Ali. Now joining us via telephone is legendary boxing promoter and trainer Lou Duva. Lou, how are you?
I'm good.
Lou, when you heard of Ali's passing on Friday night, what did it mean to you?
I felt real, real bad, as if one of my family had died, because I knew of him, and he had a trio like it with Angelo Dundee and Muhammad Ali and me, and it hurt me.
For somebody who has been around boxing for a long time, what did Muhammad Ali mean to boxing?
Muhammad Ali meant a lot to boxing. He meant a lot to the people in it. He made a lot of people. He did many things for people. He helped them. He never hurt nobody. He was a good guy.
You've been around the boxing sport, as I say, for a long time, Lou. Is he what he says he was in your eyes? Is he the greatest of all time?
There was only one guy that was really filled with his ability, and that would be Joe Louis. But as far as the fighter is concerned, I had to give it to Muhammad Ali.
What do you think his legacy is to the world and to the sport of boxing?
The legacy?
Yes.
Well, how do you really think about legacy? Do you think as thing that you dream about that could happen and didn't happen. It's something that
Lou, on Friday, his funeral will be in Louisville, Kentucky at 2 o'clock. President Bill Clinton will be speaking, Bryant Gumbel, Billy Crystal. I've heard that Larry Holmes and Don King and Chuck Wepner are all going to be in attendance for this. Are you going to be in attendance for the funeral Friday?
I don't think I can make it. I wish I could. I'm in a situation myself. In a situation like that, and I can't. I couldn't be there. But in heart and soul, I am there. I will always be there.
Lou, what was it about him that made him so great?
His ability to get the people wasn't no wise guy or none. He was a really good guy. He didn't play any sport, a special part. He was a guy that was out there and loved what he was doing.
Lou, I can't thank you enough for joining us to share your memories of this great man. And stay well, Lou, and hopefully we'll talk to you again soon.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Take care. Bye-bye. Legendary boxing trainer and promoter Lou Duva, who's trained some of the best, sharing his thoughts on Muhammad Ali. Tomorrow, coming up on this show, I should mention, we will be joined by Dr. Art Uihlein. We're going to finish our conversation with Dr. Art Uihlein on Alzheimer's, weight loss, and depression. So that's tomorrow, 12:10 to 1 p.m., Dr. Art Uihlein, former doctor on the Today Show. From 1:10 to 2 p.m. tomorrow, we will be joined by, this is very interesting, Kathleen Willey. Kathleen Willey, in 1998, accused President Bill Clinton of sexual assault. Now, since then, she has kind of gone back and forth, but tomorrow, from 1:10 to 2 p.m., she will be live on this radio program. So we will talk to her about that. You won't want to miss that tomorrow, 1:10 to 2 p.m. On Thursday, from 12:10 until Thursday at 12:10, we will be joined by Senator Sherrod Brown. And Senator Sherrod Brown is getting a lot of attention lately as a possible vice presidential candidate for Hillary Clinton, who last night presumptively captured the Democratic nomination for president. Now, all that being said, remember that coming up tomorrow, Dr. Art Uihlein from the Today Show from 12:10 to 1 p.m. talking Alzheimer's, talking depression, talking summer diets, and then 1:10 to 2 p.m. an exclusive interview live on this program with the lady who accused Bill Clinton of sexual assault in 1998, Kathleen Willey. And then on Thursday, Senator Sherrod Brown. Joining us right now is a gentleman I like to have on the program a lot, legendary journalist and journalism professor, on what is an historic day, Emil Dansker. Emil, how are you?
Well, I'm in pretty good shape. I got a car out of the body shop today.
Oh, that's good to hear. Emil, it's a big day for the world, really, as whether you're Republican or Democrat, the first woman ever to be chosen as the presumptive nominee of any political party for President of the United States has been chosen, Hillary Clinton.
And I'm well aware of the historic nature of that, and I happen to be one of her supporters aside even from sex. I think she's a terrific candidate, and I'm optimistic about how we might see, what was that slogan again about happy days will be here again?
Well, it's interesting, Emo, because this is 100 years after women, not even 100 years, after women get the right to vote. How historic is that? Is this as historic in your mind as Barack Obama being the first African American to get the nomination?
Well, I think it is. It is historic, very, very, very important. Something that was probably inevitable. It's interesting that it took this long. I remember when Shirley Chisholm was a candidate and didn't get very far at that time. I think as time has marched on, and in the case of Obama, for example, that it was something that was building and that that had to come eventually.
Do you think, much like they said with President Obama, that when people go to the polls, there will be people who vote against her strictly on the basis of being a woman?
Well, I think there's no question that there would be that. At least I don't think there's any question that there will be people who will feel that way, just as we have a lot of people voting on what shall I say, wild ideas anyway. This is an interesting election in the sense of it's bringing out a lot of people whose voice normally wouldn't be heard, and somehow or other, perhaps because of Trump's presumption, that these people are kind of coming, you might say, out of the woodwork.
There are two major stories surrounding Trump right now, and I want to start with the one that we didn't get time to talk about last week. He held his press conference after he released his money to the veterans and really took that as a 30-minute press conference just to lambaste the media, called them beauties. He said one guy from ABC, major news outlet, was a sleaze, referred to him as a sleaze three times in the conversation, and really went after them and said, when they asked him, is it going to be like this if you get in the White House? And he said, yes, why would I change now? What do you make of that as a journalist?
Well, in terms of a taking a position, it almost reminds me of the time when Charles Keating was asked whether he expected to get a return on the money he was giving political candidates, and he said something to the effect that I certainly hope so, would assume so. And Trump has his, and I think that unfortunately he, well, I don't know how I should put it. I certainly am not going to vote for him and hope he doesn't win. I think he'd be a disaster as a president. And perhaps one of the reasons is actually that he doesn't have the background in order to handle such a thing as a press conference. He doesn't have to like the press, but he can respect the role of the press as our fourth estate, for example.
Well, you know, Emo, what's very interesting to me, 44 presidents, and I don't think any of them have really enjoyed the press because their job is there to question them. But to say things like that, there has been talk, Dan Rather gave a great quote last week, that this is threatening to the First Amendment, that he is doing this.
Well, that's probably true. He does. That's another one of those things that that he doesn't understand, that he sees apparently sees everything or most things from his own point of view. Doesn't even agree with his own staff as far as the attitude towards the press. I remember somebody who was called the newspaper man's president. Was that William Howard Taft, of course, our Cincinnatian, who had been a reporter himself, and seemed to understand the role of the press. And I think it's important for an individual in public life, an individual who's going to be carrying what has been pointed out, that he's going to be carrying the codes to set off a nuclear weapon, that he have a better grounding in the world, world affairs, than he appears to have.
That being said, Anytime he does stuff like this, though, there is a great defense for him. The people who love him, and they do not go anywhere. What do you make of that?
Well, I think that's a concern, and I was just reading an article today in the New York Review of Books called Why Trump Was Inevitable, and it goes a lot into his support relative to the number of Republicans who were seeking the nomination, and almost from the beginning, he outpolled I think each of the other candidates, and the fact that there were so many of them meant that the opposition, you might say, was sort of split up. The number of people who were supporting each of the other candidates, in a sense, took it away from him and left him with which turned out to be a majority.
Well, and that being said, is the majority, in your opinion, big enough to carry him to the presidency?
Well, I'm afraid it is. I'm going to be very obvious there that. You know, I don't like this thing where people say, to be honest, because I would like to assume that a person who says something is going to be honest about it, even though I've spent my life in the business of not making assumptions. But I'm afraid that there enough people are going to come out of the woodwork who have a guy now who is expressing their feelings, their opinions. And a lot of other people are probably, unfortunately, are probably not going to vote. They're going to leave it to these guys, and it's not a good sign.
That being said, the other big thing with Donald Trump that has burst on the scene in the last week, and this is really amazing, his Trump University case is up being litigated. He has attacked the judge, called the judge a Mexican, says because he's a Mexican, he cannot be fair in this trial and needs to recuse himself because Trump's building the wall. Come to find out, the judge is of Mexican descent, but was born in Indiana, and even after all of that, on Sunday, Jake Tapper has Donald Trump on CNN and keeps asked him 23 times in the interview, is this racist? Trump would not answer yes or no. And then we get to yesterday where Donald Trump has this conference call where they think Trump is going to say back off of this. And he tells them, don't you listen to anybody. Don't pay attention to any memo. Go after him. Don't back down at all, and keep on hitting this judge. What is this racism?
I think it is. Yeah, it's leaning on race as a concern. The fact that the judge he says is Mexican, which he isn't, and hasn't been, he picks up on this point and runs with it. And there's really nobody to stop him. Even the people, even on his own staff, who may caution him in that regard, he doesn't listen to because he's his man. He's himself. He just does his thing.
Bill Clinton gave a speech yesterday in which, and I'm just paraphrasing because I don't have the quote in front of me, but he went after Trump's Make America Great slogan, and he said he was a Southern Protestant, and he understands what Make America Great means, what the subtext is, and it's not good for African Americans, it's not good for Latinos, it's not good for transgender people, it's not good for the LGBT community. That's what President Bill Clinton said. Do you think there's something in that?
Well, I think so. That in a way, Trump, in one sense, we give him, I hate to put it this way, in a sense of give him credit because he speaks his mind. He's him and he says it. But he disregards, these other things to him are irrelevant. And so in a sense, he's attacked everybody. Everybody but himself, and there are people out there who are going to pick up on that.
Lindsey Graham.
And vote for him.
Well, and but his own party, Lindsey Graham, who this morning, or it was late yesterday, early this morning, I saw it this morning, released a quote that said, there has not been a candidate who has said things in regard to the Mexican thing like this since Joe McCarthy.
That's a good point, yeah. And I remember Joe McCarthy very well. In fact, I covered him, and I have a picture that I took of him holding in his hand the papers when he said, I have here in my hand this list of communists. I remember Joe McCarthy very well, and he had his comeuppance, but I'm not sure what's going to happen with Trump. You know, one thing that has occurred to me, when and if he runs and loses, he himself is not going to change, and he's going to be a kind of a wild man in the background, saying all of these things. You know, you think back to Huey Long, in a sense, when Huey Long was taking a very, very strong position, running very well, and who knows what would have happened if he hadn't happened to have been assassinated in the Capitol in Louisiana. He said things. Father Coughlin said things. Hitler said things. They keep going until there's some way of stopping them. And I'm not sure what that's going to be with Trump.
You live in Ohio. I live in Ohio. The Republican convention's in Ohio. The protesters are getting a little more violent. When Trump gives a speech somewhere or has a rally, he seems to be inciting people by saying the things that he says. By the time we get to July, could there be danger up in Cleveland?
Say again?
By the time we get to the convention in July, could there be a lot of danger in Cleveland?
Well, I wouldn't deny that. You know, I remember Kent State very well. I remember other situations. I've been in tough situations. I've been slugged in the course of covering conflict. These things do have a way of building up. I'm satisfied that the security people are especially vigilant there. I've also been, I've covered, you know, I think 16 political conventions, and have gone through the security, the local police, and local law enforcement, and Secret Service that way. And they do a pretty good job, and they're certainly going to be in Cleveland and in the other all throughout it. The very, I think we got a telephone problem there.
I think something's going on. Yeah, that's very strange. But that being said, when it all comes down to it, is there anything that's going to stop Trump? Do you think there's going to be a point where his own party, the Republican Party, for their own safety, says we need to do something?
Well, to stop him, well, in a sense, no. We just have to let things play out. We have a political campaign. We have voters, non-voters, people expressing themselves in various ways on various topics, like too often on such things as the media and racism, I'm not sure what's going to stop the juggernaut. This article in the New York Review of Books that I just got this morning was headed "Why Trump Was Inevitable," and that was based on polling the other candidates. In a sense, they diluted the vote.
I tell you, it's an amazing time. Emil, I'm sorry we don't have more time, but I thank you for dropping by, and it's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Great.
Thank you so much. Emil Dansker, legendary journalist here in the state of Ohio. We've got a lot more interesting programming coming up this week. As I said, you won't want to go anywhere. Tomorrow, it's Dr. Art Uhlein talking about depression, talking about summer diets, and talking about Alzheimer's. At 1 o'clock, it's Kathleen Willey, the person who was sexually assaulted by allegedly sexually assaulted by Bill Clinton. We'll have her live tomorrow, 1:10 to 2 o'clock. And then on Thursday, Senator Sherrod Brown, who there was a big article in the newspaper yesterday about how Sherrod Brown may likely be the vice presidential candidate, and we will talk to him about that. If there's anybody out there who'd like to weigh in on anything in this hour, Muhammad Ali or anything Emil Dansker said, give me a call, 740-383-9944. We've got about 2 minutes left. 740-383-9944. Give me a ring, and we will get you up on the air. And don't forget the big two-year WWGH celebration coming up on Friday, 12:10 to 1 p.m. Marge Hazel will be here, Marianne Michaels, Charlie Evers, myself, Sean Kraft, Terry Tackett. Big thing going on. And you can get us on the TuneIn app. Don't forget, any mobile device you have, just download the free TuneIn app. And you can get us all over the world. Just search WWGH. We are always streaming live on our website, www.wwgh1071.com. And you can shoot me an email, scott@wwgh1071.com. And also search for us on Facebook. Exclusive content, pictures, and guests coming up on the show, always available on Facebook by searching WWGH Radio, Marion, Ohio, and clicking like. Nisa Stump, downtown Marion manager, coming up in hour number two today after we take the 10-minute break, so that will be a lot of fun discussing what's going on in downtown Marion. And again, a pretty historic day. The first woman ever elected or nominated by a major party for President of the United States, Hillary Clinton. We'll be back in about 10 minutes. Don't change the dial.
You're listening to WWGH Radio 107.1 FM, LP Marion, the talking place. For legendary talk show host Larry King,